Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are having a special broadcast because ITVS, POV, the Community Cinema, is having a special screening of ASGO's Janesville, which actually you might have seen on PBS last Monday. And it's like, oh, what happened? It's like, oh. Well, anyway, so if you missed it, you can see it at the San Francisco Main Library tomorrow, October 16th. Doors open at 5:15, and then the film is going to screen from 5:30 to 6:30. And afterwards, there are going to be these wonderful community organizers in the house, and Oscar Graham, from community organizer from Ponder, People Organizing to Demand Environmental and Economic Rights, Rashida Greenwich, director of Pueblo People United for a Better Life in Oakland, and Stephen Maduli-Williams, CEO, San Francisco Housing Development Corporation. And you'll see how all that's connected to As Goes Janesville, So Goes the Rest of the World, So Goes the Rest of the Country, I think. we're joined in the studio by Brad. How do you pronounce your last name, Brad?
Oh, I pronounce that Lichtenstein.
Lichtenstein. Okay, I didn't want to mess it up. Yeah, and he's going to tell us about this wonderful film. And I don't know, you're in Chicago now, so I don't know if you're going to be flying out to San Francisco, but maybe you are. Are you?
Oh, I wish. No, I'm actually heading to screenings in Houston and Philadelphia next.
Okay.
Yeah, and you guys have a bunch of great people lined up. I did want to point out that it's actually Independent Lens, not POV.
Oh, it is Independent Lens. Okay, thank
you. Yeah, and with Independent Lens being based in San Francisco, I definitely wanted to get that right.
Oh, certainly. Thank you. I'm sure they are really happy that we corrected that. Well, let me read your bio, and then we could just jump right into this film, which is quite a study. And it's interesting how, you know, your wife is from Janesville, and I had never heard of Janesville. Of course, I've heard of General Motors. Everyone has, especially after what happened with the bailouts. But I hadn't known about that particular town and how the closure of the plant affected so many lives. You know, we hear about it, but it's real sort of academic, and you know, we feel really badly, but we don't know the people. We can't put a human face on the closures like we can now that you made this wonderful document. But Brad is an award-winning filmmaker and president of Wisconsin-based 371 Productions, and he could tell us what 371 means. Is that the area code or something?
It's actually when I moved from New York to Milwaukee. I was teaching for 5 years, and my classroom number was 371.
Oh, how cute. That must have been a great class for you to name your production company after. They must have been really great folks, great students.
Oh, I was just trying to avoid all of those sort of overwrought production company names.
Yeah, so 371 Productions, a media and technology company that produces social issue documentaries, public engagement campaigns, technology projects, and more. Before making his own films, Brad Associate produced Frontline's Peabody Award-winning presidential election year special, Choice 96, and Lumiere Productions' PBS series, With God on Our Side, The History of the Religious Right. With Lumiere, he produced and directed Andre's Lives, a portrait of the Jewish Schindler, Safe, about domestic violence, Caught in the Crossfire, about Arab Americans after 9/11, and the BBC/Court TV's co-production of Ghosts of Attica, about the infamous 1971 prison uprising and aftermath, for which he was awarded a DuPont Columbia Award for Excellence in Journalism. His film Almost Home, about people who live and work in a Milwaukee elder care community, aired on Independent Lens and continues to be featured in workshops on aging and caregiving. 371 will also soon launch Viz Viz, a transmedia component of As Goes Janesville Project, a mobile app and website that makes business visible. That sounds really interesting. Right now, we talked about this before we went on the air, that you're developing a transmedia project called DJ Spooky's Quest for the Commons, about the things we share from water to knowledge to the Internet. And in addition to that, and I think I'll let you talk about sort of other future projects like the reality game and stuff like that. That sounds interesting. So reality game, As Goes Janesville app, right?
Right, so, well, Yeah. Less a game, more an app. But, yeah, for sure, we can talk about that.
Yeah, no. I just meant humorously, like As Goes Janeville, the board game.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So tell us about Janesville, Wisconsin, Paul Ryan's hometown, and these four people that you follow, these four people that are directly connected to this the closure of the plant and moving to where did they move to?
Fort Wayne, right? Gail in the TV version, and the feature version, there's another woman too who moves to Fort Wayne to work at the GM plant in Fort Wayne because there's no decent paying jobs in Janesville, Wisconsin once the GM plant is closed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I was trying to do is I wanted to be able to tell a story about our economic crisis from the points of view of a lot of different people. And that's why I purposely went out and tried to get access to one family that is struggling, having been GM workers at the Janesville plant, and trying to figure out whether they should take a job that only pays $7 to $9 an hour in town and basically have to completely upend their lives financially, or, and I focused on women for this reason too, or to see what happens when the central caregiver in the family has to leave her family behind. You know, they can't sell their house. It's underwater. Nobody's selling houses. So she ends up moving to Fort Wayne and trying to commute back on weekends when she can, you know, depending on whether GM has workers staying for overtime or, you know, some other reason on the weekends. It's about a 4.5-hour commute for her. So she's essentially gone, and her husband, who's on disability because he had been injured in the plant, actually takes over kind of running the home and the house and caring for their two daughters who are in high school and middle school. And then I wanted to follow a worker who stays and who completely reinvents herself. She goes back to school. She used to work at the Alcoa plant that made the tire rims for the GM products. And so she decides to go back to school and become a medical technician. And she's one of these people who does everything right. She even graduates top of her class at the vocational school. But then when she gets out, she still can't find a job. And the unemployment has run out. And it turns out, too, that she has a pretty major health crisis with the possibility that she has breast cancer. And so we really see her kind of going right up to the end of the line before her fortunes are about to change. And then I wanted to follow a conservative business point of view. And so I latched on to a group in this town that was focusing on economic development, and they essentially really were a business group who also had the county and the city economic development directors as part of it. And they are led by one woman who I follow, who is a local banker in town. And when Governor Scott Walker, who sort of became famous as the person who led the effort to end collective bargaining rights for public workers in Wisconsin, when he is elected, Mary and her colleagues at Rock County 5.0, their business group, become very, I think the word would be, intoxicated with the potential of having such alignment with a conservative political leader whose mantra is that Wisconsin is open for business and who wants to get rid of regulations and who wants to endorse tax cuts. And so much so that there's actually a scene in the film where you see the head of the Chamber of Commerce meeting with Mary and other business leaders, and they talk about how it's a good thing that all the GM workers are gone because now if they bring in a new factory to town, they can pay them less.
Right,
so
and I wonder, like, why? Why do they say that on camera?
Well, the reason they say it on camera is that I had a great deal of access to everybody in the film. I was in the homes of workers who were laid off, and I was in boardrooms that were closed to the public. And the way I get that access, and you know, I've learned this from really terrific documentary filmmakers I've worked with over the years, is that I build a relationship of trust with everybody in the film. And my promise is that I'm going to show everybody exactly as who they are. Like I feel like my job is fulfilled if when they watch the film, they really recognize themselves in it, even if there are things in the film that perhaps they wish they had not said. And certainly that scene, and also a scene in which Governor Walker tells Mary, the person I'm following, and the, her colleague, Diane Hendricks, who's a billionaire, that he has a plan to divide and conquer the unions,
yes,
is something else that he probably wishes that he had not said on camera, because that actually became part of the whole recall election news cycle here in Wisconsin, and it also became national news. It was repeated on almost every single news program for a week. But, you know, that scene was a scene that I captured in full knowledge of everybody in the room, and I was introduced to the governor, and I told him that I was working on a PBS documentary, and I made a promise that nothing he said would see the light of day for a year, and I kept that promise. But when we released the trailer in May, that divide and conquer scene became viral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really amazing. And then another amazing scene was when Mary, the banker, they were talking about this, I don't know if it was a pharmaceutical company, but a company coming in, and they wanted to have a tax break and a shrine, the shrine deal, and they wanted to get a tax incentive, and they were going to only, it was $9 million. They were only going to generate 125 jobs. And it wasn't going to happen until, I think, 2014 or something like that.
15, right.
And it was going to take 20% of the city's budget. And only one council person opposed it. And they kept on calling the question. He said no. And then one person in the audience was saying, it doesn't seem like it's going to benefit the people. And then it passed. And they're like having, they're toasting it later on in another scene. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, I was like so amazed that it just passed like that. And I'm thinking, well, if it passed there, it's probably passing in other similar kind of gatherings of elected officials, you know, in constituency saying no, but then it passing anyway all around the country.
That's exactly right. I mean, I've always thought of the story of Janesville as being a kind of microcosm of the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, when I started, I didn't know that Paul Ryan would become the vice presidential candidate. So I figured that even that, as the name implies, Janesville, it sounds like it could be the name of any town in America. And you know, as goes Janesville, so goes America. And
right.
What one of our characters, there's a fourth character that we didn't talk about yet named Tim Cullen.
I like him. He's great.
He comes out of retirement to run for the state Senate, and he calls the process of putting public money up to try to get a company to move to your town as legalized blackmail. And, of course,
right.
It goes on everywhere. And what was significant, I think, about it in Janesville is that the group, Rock County 5.0, the business leaders, they were the ones who were in the loop. And they were talking to city council members, and there was an effort to go member by member and lobby them and persuade them to vote in favor of this $9 million incentive package, which, by the way, is not just cash. I mean, it includes other kinds of things that cities and counties can provide, like a sewage and water treatment line moving, and part of it is a tax incremental financing district deal. So it's not all just cash, but nonetheless, it's public assets.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question I kept asking was, you know, well, will there be a public hearing? Will there be some opportunity for the public to weigh in and also to look at the third-party assessment of this company, Shine Medical, which actually makes medical isotopes. It's sort of in the pharmaceutical industry, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never anything like that. There was an open house, but that was really something that the company held with its boosters. It wasn't really a forum to ask about the product itself, which is a nuclear product that's regulated by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and to ask about the amount of money that's being put up and what the return on investment would be. And so, you know, when you have one guy at a city council meeting who raises an issue, that's pretty much all of the dissent that was ever allowed. And, you know, I think ultimately the problem here, and this happens everywhere, is that economic development is not a very inclusive process. And so when it turns out that your own assets are being put up to attract businesses, there's been no discussion about whether that return is going to benefit you as a citizen. I think that's one of the most important questions that's raised by the film.
Right, yes. And I wanted to mention some of these characters by name that you mentioned.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, like, you know, you mentioned Mary Wilman is the banker. And, it, you know, the way it starts out, you know, her daughters are talking about, well, Mom, what are we going to do about this? And then it just seemed like she's such a crusader for the good.
She's an ambassador of optimism, as she self-appointed herself to be.
Right, right. That's really funny. And then, you know, Cindy Deegan, she, the woman who goes back to school and you know, studies for another trade, and she says how she wanted to go, you know, become a school teacher, but there was no money, so she joined the military. So she's a veteran.
Right.
And,
right.
And then at the same time, the unemployment is running out. She got COBRA, as, you know, she has this medical crisis. That's getting ready to run out. And all these things are happening at the same time. You know, she's going to the job fairs, and they're like, no promises, because they're building a hospital too. And I'm thinking,
right.
Oh, okay, well, she's studying something in the medical field. That seemed like a automatic match there. And she's a resident. It seemed like they should, like, guarantee employment for qualified Janesville residents, you know, as a business, you know, wanting to do the right thing in a town that has suffered, you know, such an economic, you know, crisis. But that's not the case. Because the woman says, no, I'm not going to remember to call you or something like that.
Right. Right. That,
like,
was,
wow,
that was
really
during the job fair. Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, Gail Listenby, you know, she's like putting in applications. You know, she's making $28 an hour. And she's looking, and all she can find is like jobs from like $6 or $7 to $9 max. And
right.
So she's the one that has to leave her daughters with, you know, with her husband who was injured. That sounds like a really horrific injury. That sounds so painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh. And then go back and forth, a 4-hour transport, and then she wants to retire early. And then there's like they said you showed something like a flash. There's no early retirement in GM. And then the other woman who has to leave her child, he's 18, Angie Hodges, that's a really sad story because she gets fired after she relocates. I'm like, whoa.
Right.
No
right.
love.
And she relocates because, I mean, she's fired because she was taking care of her son
mm-hmm.
who got into a car accident.
Right, and she had never taken off, no sick leave, all for 24 years. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's amazing. And then the union helps her get a job, but then there's, you know, her record is tarnished.
Right.
But, yeah, they don't take into consideration, well, this woman never used her sick leave in 24 years. You owe her leave. So
right.
just, you know, let it balance itself out. But that doesn't happen.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, Angie's story is, I think, one of those where she's, and I kind of purposely did this. She's not a union activist.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I did not want to follow activists, actually, because I really wanted for the audience to see how just regular people who are working at a factory deal with the hardships that they're faced with. So when she gets her job back and the union helps her, you're right to point out that it's kind of bittersweet because it doesn't change the fact that her record is going to be marred. And, you know, as her brother tells her, it's like living in a prison. It's like you're just trying to do your time and then get out at retirement. So it really sours, I think, her whole outlook after she goes through that being fired and having to try to work hard to get her job back that she should never lost in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And then her son, I mean, we don't know, you know, how he's doing because they're so close. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, he's like loses his anchor. I mean, he's 18. It's time for him to like go to college and, you know, think about a career. And the person that offers him that guidance, she took him to school every single day. She said she would get off from work, have like an hour or two of sleep, and then take him to school. And
yeah.
So now she's gone. So it doesn't matter. The grandmother's there and uncle is there. His mother's not there.
Right, right.
Yeah,
absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, both of these women come from really strong families. You know, Angie's a single mom, whereas Gail is still married to the same man, you know, that she's had her family with, and they have this huge extended family. Both of them do.
Mm-hmm.
But, I, you know, there was some of my favorite footage on the cutting room floor is actually with Gail's family where I was shooting at Christmas time with her. She was, her family was all GMers, and they were some of the first people to integrate the plant. As she's African American, for people who don't know, in Radio Land, and so she's they're one of the first families to integrate the plant in Janesville in the 1970s. There's an enormous amount of pride actually in all that, and there's a scene on the cutting room floor when they were kind of telling me that, and we were all together at Christmas, and a call came, and someone in their church had been thrown out of their apartment on Christmas Eve because of foreclosure. And they immediately took up a collection of money and food and other kinds of stuff. And I rode with them, and it was Gail's husband, Tim, and their two daughters, and we rode to, a sort of like a roadside Super 8, very dingy, where this family, which was three generations, it was grandmother, granddaughter, and three or four children, all kind of crammed into this little motel room, who had been thrown out on Christmas Eve. And Tim and the girls delivered a huge number of bags of food and money just to help them get through. And I just thought, here's this family who's going through this very wrenching displacement themselves, as Gail has already had to leave. And here they are, on a spur of the moment, total Christmas spirit, helping another family in need, which moved me a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Because in the beginning of the film, you show, I'm not certain what the season is, but people are getting bags of groceries delivered. I mean, people are.
Yeah, that's. Mm-hmm. Right. That's Tim, who's delivering. Yeah. One of the things that happened in Janesville is that the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, used to run a massive Christmas food drive. And then once GM shut down and their ranks were decimated because so many families had to relocate, they no longer could really do this themselves. So they actually partnered with the school board. And Tim had been one of the people very involved with the schools. And so he had volunteered to deliver groceries that day, which is kind of how we meet him, is delivering groceries.
Right.
It's like from the start, something you said really resonated with me, and that is that we're trying to tell human stories, because I think people have the sense that, that was back in 2008. GM shut down 39 plants altogether. They received government support. They're getting back on their feet. And we tend not to really know or wonder, maybe, what's going on with these families that were affected. But these were tens of thousands of families that were affected. And it's not just GM. I think in general, we look at waning unemployment, and we know that it hits certain communities harder than other communities, and it sticks. And so it's not like there's just one traumatic day when a person loses their job. It affects those families for sometimes many, many years, maybe a generation or generations. And so what I'm trying to do is to take you inside and understand how these families are coping. And it's not just, how hard it is, but also how resilient they are in the adaptation that they figure out how to do.
Mm-hmm. Right, certainly. And what I also like is how you connect the dots for us by showing how the to support these They have these great slogans. Rock County Alliance, Ambassadors of Optimism. Okay.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And so, you show about, the cutting the jobs of 200 teachers getting laid off for the money to be reallocated to build roads or something like that. I mean,
you're referring to a moment where, when Governor Walker became Wisconsin's governor, it was not just the end of collective bargaining, but in the name of deficit reduction, he was claiming that there were all kinds of reasons why government programs can no longer be supported. Now, one of the things that Tim Cullen, our state senator, points out is that it wasn't so much that he was plugging a gap. He was shifting money from education to build roads. And, guess what? One of the largest, if not the largest, I think it's second largest to manufacturers, the largest lobby in terms of donation and support for that governor comes from the road builders,
wow.
Which is just ironic also because they, many of them in their lobbying position is staunchly conservative and therefore very much anti-government, and yet their largest contracts are government contracts, whether it's building roads or building public university buildings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so the students actually go on strike in Janesville because what the effect on them is that their classes are getting cut because the teachers have to cut 200 jobs as a result.
Right, yeah, which directly affects the quality of education.
Indeed, yeah.
Right, yeah. And then, Senator Cullen, you know, he's great with these really short, pithy, insightful comments. You know, who will govern us, the people or the money? I think that was him.
Right, that's definitely him. That's a giant rally that I think a lot of your listeners, I think the whole nation probably saw that rally when the Democratic senators from Wisconsin returned from Illinois, and there were 100,000 people in the streets in Madison when they returned. And there's a video on our website, which is asgoesjanesville.com, that shows how I got access to that because the senators were not allowed to bring anybody with them, and I had my camera, of course, and they were only allowed one family member. So Tim's wife does not like big crowds, and 100,000 is a pretty big crowd. So I went with Tim. And as they were sort of, you know, pushing me to the side, Tim yells, "He's my family, he's my family." And that's how I got into the middle of that throng.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I really like that at the on your website. There's a clip, I think it's on your website or it's on ITVS website, about, you know, sort of how do we make this film, how do we get access.
That's really exactly the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very nice.
You know, we also put up a bunch of outtakes with Paul Ryan because I did interview him twice, and I shot with him on four or five different occasions. So at asgoesjanesville.com, we also have a bunch of clips of Paul Ryan talking to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So this film actually is going to have a theatrical release too, right? It's going to come to our theaters as it already has come to, you know, ITVS on here. Public broadcasting station, which is KQED, Channel 9.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, it's not a theatrical release. We're doing a non-theatrical release, which means that we're showing the feature version, the one that has Angie, the woman who loses her job when her son's in the car accident.
Yes.
That version, which is 88 minutes, as opposed to the TV version, which is 53 minutes.
Oh.
That version is touring the country at film festivals. And we're also doing community screenings. And our main thrust is what we're calling Biz Lab, which is an effort to try to bring business and labor and civic groups and community groups together so that economic development is a more inclusive process and that we can try to overcome some of the really stark political polarization that's characterized our country in the last few years.
Mm-hmm. So
that's traveling around the country.
Is that what you're traveling with? Like, you know, you mentioned a few stops that you're making, you know, as we speak. Is that the 88-minute version of the film? Is that
the longer version? And Community Cinema is actually showing the longer version in a lot of its forums too. And then an example of what we're doing is, like, for instance, in Nashville, we've been working with local business groups, local labor groups and community groups to make sure that the screening has a population of people who may very well disagree about politics and about collective bargaining and about a lot of the issues that are raised in the film. But we want to get that dialogue going because we feel like if we don't, you know, we're just all going to be talking to each other in our bubbles. And then later in that, the next day, actually, we've invited leaders of these groups to come together and have a very honest dialogue about the tough issues like wages, so that you don't have people holed up in a room who hold the future of a town in their hands get away with just saying, oh, well, let's bring this company in so we can pay them less. That, you know, that's not something that should happen. What should happen is that everybody should be at a table and we should all be talking about how economic development can benefit the broader portion of the community.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Gail actually was at Gail Lissenby was at the rally, I think, in Madison.
Right.
And she had her daughter with her because she wanted her to see about collective bargaining and how important unions were. And she talked to her about, you know, how unions made sure that the employees had a decent wage and that they had, you know, fair hours and, you know, weren't overworked and had, you know, good working conditions, safe working conditions. And I really liked that, the rally scene and all the shames. And then when you went to another scene where, I guess it was it Paul Ryan was going to speak, I'm not certain, and Senator Cullen told people that they should let him speak. They were unveiling a program, and it was totally against the people. And then someone called him, what did they call him?
They called him despicable and a fake liberal.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, that scene, I hope, shows what I'm trying to get across, which is that, you know, in part it's the governor's fault because he tried to introduce a bill that was divisive without trying to include anybody at the table. And so the state blew up. And you see how it bleeds into everything. So when Janesville has a business banquet, it's usually a very tranquil affair, it blows up into protests. And when the state tries to dedicate a tourism stop on the highway, it blows up into a giant, war. And that's where Tim is trying to quiet people. And then he himself gets accused of essentially being a turncoat. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I love that because, you know, here's this guy who has devoted his entire adult life to fairness and equal rights and through the political system. And he's getting called that, you know, by a young man who's probably, I'm going to guess, a third of his age, if not a fourth of his age, which doesn't mean anything necessarily, but you see kind of, I think, the pain in Tim's response to that. He's just like, whoa, boy, you know, people don't get what I've worked for and what I'm about for my entire life. And, you know, that's the state of Wisconsin at that point, which is really, I think, the state of the union.
Mm-hmm. Oh, certainly. And what's really, really great that you have this document is that perhaps the banker Mary Willman and her partner, who we don't, you know, see on camera, you know, being interviewed as much. I'm sure she's in the room, but I don't know who she is exactly. That when she, you know, when they see themselves, that they feel shame, like for real. Like, you know, when they hear these four stories, which can be multiplied like so many times and a lot worse, that they think about just selling out, you know, these members of their community like this. I hope. Anyway.
Yeah. All I can say to that is yeah.
So what does your wife think? You mentioned that you know about this town because this is your wife's hometown.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm sure she's like, so is your wife, did her family, were they GM people and like a lot of the people that you profile?
No, my wife's father, so my father-in-law was the first in his family to go to college. He was actually grew up in Milwaukee, but moved to Janesville after law school at UW-Madison. And became a lawyer. And funny enough, he was a partner in a practice where Paul Ryan's father was a partner as well. So they also knew the Ryans. Now, they were politically very different, but nonetheless, in fact, Paul Ryan's mom came to my engagement party because she's good friends with my mother-in-law. So that was an interesting connection to have. And it's been very interesting now because the business community is very upset with me. And I've had a couple screenings in the area and, you know, it's become fodder for the newspaper editorial department, the editor of the paper who wrote an editorial yesterday sort of saying that I've maligned some very good people. And it's made Mary and her colleagues very upset. But, you know, it's hard to, you know, I don't quite know what to do about that. It is what it is.
Yeah, it is. You didn't create it. You just filmed it.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's interesting. So what did your wife think?
Of the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, well, gosh, I've learned that I should not talk for my wife.
Okay.
she likes the movie, but I definitely don't want to get her in trouble with anybody.
Okay.
I can say that my father-in-law is very pleased with it.
Okay, cool. That's awesome. Oh, wow, that's great. So have you already come through California, you know, on this 88-minute sort of film as a collaboration point or a point for people to come together around a table and talk about the issues as well as implementation of some things that went wrong there to make things better? Because, you know, housing is an issue here, employment is an issue here, education is an issue here in California, northern and southern and, you know,
right.
California,
right.
You know, because everybody's broke. At least that's what they say anyway.
Right.
So have you already come through and we just missed you?
No.
No,
because we had our broadcast just October 8th,
yeah.
And we're just now beginning a lot of these other events. I mean, we have actually screened the film, I'm pretty sure, at a couple of festivals. We actually won 3 awards in L.A. at the Independent Film Quarterly Festival there. But whenever I do a film, I want to have an impact that gets sustained for a very long time. And so my hope is that we will continue to do this kind of work throughout California and throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm.
My gosh, I mean, I'd be happy if we can do this until we don't need to do it anymore, until, you know, we're in a position where we look at fairness and equality with all of the economic development deals that we do as a nation in communities and, you know, and at a national level.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. So talk about some of the media that extends the film, the BizViz and other things that you're
sure.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to so we have another broadcast coming up on January 28th on Independent Lens. And timed with that, we're going to launch what's called BizViz, which is an app, a mobile app, that will allow you to take a picture of a logo or a product and instantly learn about the company behind that logo or product, whether or not they've paid their taxes and how much, to learn a little bit about their employment practices and also about they and their industry's contributions to political campaigns. So there's campaign finance data. And that's actually a partnership between us and the Sunlight Foundation and Citizens for Tax Justice and Good Jobs First. So we're right now, we've got most of the data done. We've got a beta of it. You can go to BizViz, which is BizViz.com, and just see sort of a mock-up of what it's going to look like. But that will actually be live, and we'll be reaching out for people to download it starting in sometime in January. And it'll be great if people do, because if we get 5,000 downloads in 48 hours, then we move to the top of the iTunes store, of the App Store.
Nice, nice. Oh, we need it right now, though, because we have an election on November 6th, and we need to, like, you know, be hitting all the
yes.
the logos for all of the merchandise that, you know, that is popping up around campaigns.
Well, there is right now, if you go to the AFL-CIO's website, I'm pretty sure, and there's also something called Crocodile, I think, spelled with a Y. They have website versions of something that works kind of like this.
Oh.
So that's worth checking out.
Oh, that sounds really great. Making businesses visible. Wow, that's excellent.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Really wonderful. Yeah, wow. So tell me about your latest project. But before you do that, your film Safe about domestic violence, the one you worked on, it sounds really great. What year was that?
Oh, thank
is
you.
Is it still available?
Unfortunately, I don't think it is. You know, before I started my own company, I worked for another company, and so the copyright's held by that company for everything I did. And Safe was done for the Discovery Channel. It was about, I followed 3 women who were spending 30 days in a domestic violence shelter that gave them an opportunity to sort of get their lives back on track and get away from their abusers. And it's a really interesting film. I mean, each woman is going through a very different sort of circumstance. One woman is also very abusive herself, and she's trying to figure out how to sort of stop all of the aggression in her life so that she can not pass that on to her children. Another woman is trying to resist the temptation to return to her abuser, which is unfortunately very common. And then a third woman is trying to figure out how to explain to her children where she is, and that they're in a domestic violence shelter. So, I love that film. I wish it was widely available. There might be some way to watch it on the internet for illegally, which would be fine by me, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah, because this, I believe October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, if I'm not mistaken. And because I was walking Lake Merritt on Saturday, and an organization called A Safe Place was having its annual sort of walk, fundraising walk. And I just thought, wow, in Safe. And I'm thinking, oh, this will be just perfect if it was available to be able to show it, now as well as, make it available. Oh, darn, I'll have to look for that. And
well,
then,
if one calls the Discovery channel, there might be some way they would release it for things like that.
Okay, excellent, super. And the BBC Court TV co-production of Ghosts of Attica, tell me about that. It's about the 1971 prison uprising and aftermath.
It is. Yeah, that was a film that we made at the point where it had been a 30-year case and it was being resolved by New York State. Mm-hmm. And I followed the story of both the guards and the prisoners, both of whom were shot and killed and injured at Attica when Nelson Rockefeller sent in troops. He was the governor of New York at the time, sent in troops to quell the uprising in 1971. And as many people probably remember, it was a massacre. They dropped tear gas. You couldn't see what was going on, and they shot shotguns into a crowd. And so 29 inmates and 10 of the guards who were being held hostage were killed when the smoke cleared. And then there was the guards received nothing because when they signed their workmen's compensation checks, they waived their right to sue the state. And in the case of the inmates, they had sued, and at a certain point in the legal process, the court said that they could not bring a class action, so now you had to bring all these individual lawsuits. And it took all these years for that to get adjudicated, and eventually there was a settlement. And so we tried to weave the historical story and the present story, at the time present story, together in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I highly recommend that to people, and you can get it through First Run Icarus Films.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think it's over 40 years now since it happened. Yeah.
1971, that's right, 41 years.
Yeah.
So, I screened it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music last year for the 40th anniversary.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did.
Yeah, because
I have a confession to make to you. I'm getting calls in from another radio show that I'm supposed to be on, and I certainly don't want to shortchange our conversation.
Okay.
But I can hear that they've tried about 7 times to reach
me. Okay, well, in closing, tell me about your DJ Spooky quest for the Commons.
Sure. So for those people who don't know, DJ Spooky, also known as Paul Miller in regular life, is a DJ, and he's also an intellectual and an experimental artist. People might be familiar with the show he's done recently about ice, where he traveled to the Arctic. He shot a lot of footage of ice, and he created a kind of remix symphony experimental sound show that he performs live. With that. He's a really, really eclectic, interesting artist. And so I've teamed up with him and with Vernon Reed, who is the co-founder of Living Color, the rock band, and also the musical director of Kamau Bell's new show, Totally Biased, which you should check out.
Yeah,
well,
Kamau Bell is here. We know him.
Oh, cool. Yeah, Kamau's
yeah.
awesome. So Vernon and Paul and I are working on trying to create a transmedia experience that explores all the things that belong to all of us that are threatened by over-privatization, from water to the internet itself to democracy. And it's a project that you know, we continue to try to figure out because it's a behemoth. But one of these days, and I hope one of these days very soon, we're going to be able to bring it to the public. I should mention that we actually incubated that project at the Bay Area Video Coalition, where I was fortunate enough to be invited to be part of what they call their New Media Producers Institute. And that and BayVac is actually doing that institute right now. So it's a very cool program.
Oh, that's awesome.
I thank you for asking about that because I love that project.
Yeah. Well, DJ Spooky of the Subliminal Kid has been here lots of times. He had a collaboration with the Oakland East Bay Symphony. He was recently here at the School of Journalism. They did this thing around alternative media, you know, using alternative media using the web, you know, based radio and also TV and things like that. So,
He's really a one-of-a-kind kind of guy.
Yeah, he's really brilliant, and I like his book too. He was teaching at MIT, or he went to MIT.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you're a better woman than I if you can understand that book. It's got too much academia in me for me to read it. And I almost got a PhD in philosophy.
Oh, you do?
Well, I was in philosophy school to get a PhD when I dropped out to become a filmmaker.
Okay. Yeah, I like philosophy. Yeah. I have an undergraduate degree in philosophy.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Well, it certainly comes through in your wonderful film and films. And I want to thank you so much for putting that person, you know, on hold. And I'm going to let you go now to your other interview.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being with you.
All right, sure. You take good care. And thank you so much for the great film.
All right. Take care. Thanks.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, wow. So that was really great. That's director Brad Lichtenstein, producer and director of this wonderful film, As Goes Janeville, community cinema, ITV, yes, and it's going to be screening tomorrow, the shorter version, at the ITVS, KQED, Potter, Pueblo, and San Francisco Housing Development Corporation, the San Francisco Public Library, free screening tomorrow evening at the main branch of the San Francisco Main Library. Well, that's kind of redundant. 100 Larkin Street in San Francisco in the Corrett Auditorium. And again, the doors open at 5:15 and the screening is at 5:30. And then afterwards, it's going to be a great, great discussion about how As Goes Janesville, So Goes San Francisco, San Francisco City and County, As Goes Alameda County, Oakland, Berkeley, Alameda City, San Leandro, et cetera, et cetera. As Goes Contra Costa County, you know, Richmond, Orinda, a lot of other places. So goes the country. So, it's a really enlightening film, and, I'm really looking forward to this project that they're working on with DJ Spooky. When DJ Spooky came out here and he was collaborating with the Oakland East Bay Symphony, he did his piece, sort of a remix of, actually that was at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. He did a remix of Birth of a Nation for the Oakland East Bay Symphony. I don't remember what he did. I don't think it was Birth of a Nation, but that was really interesting, looking at the remix of Birth of a Nation at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. That was really fascinating. And he comes out here quite a lot. Paul Miller, he is brilliant. I think his mother is at Howard University. He's got like super duper parents. Thinker and an artist. He's uses hip hop culture to remix sort of idioms so that we can rethink sort of principles and values that we hold and sort of remix the language so that we can see it in a clearer way. And I remember when he was at Yerba Buena, when he did the remix of Birth of a Nation, there was actually a conversation connected to that. and he's a great great lecturer as well. So really, really happy that Brad is working with DJ Spooky, and yeah, it's really a great film. Quite intense and quite thought provoking and quite chilling, because As Goes Janesville is, you know, it's just the tip of the iceberg, because it's just one town that's so many other towns like our town. So it's really, really great. Alrighty, so I am rambling. Let me play a song. I think I'm going to play Archie Shepp's Revolution. I played it before, and it's a really good, really good piece. And he was so phenomenal when he was in town last weekend. Hope you were all able to catch him. If not, he tours, and I think he'll be in this country for a little bit longer before he heads back overseas where he lives and where he tours quite extensively. Okay, so Archie Shepp going to play. Oh, July, I really like Cousin Mary. I think I'm going to play, I like Revolution. but I really like Cousin Mary. I'm going to play Cousin Mary. Thank you.